Hi there, welcome along to High Performance, our gift to you for free every week. This podcast turns the lived experience of the planet's highest performers into life lessons for you. So allow the greatest thinkers, leaders, sports stars, entertainers, and entrepreneurs to be your teacher. And one of the things I love about this podcast is that when we have a guest on who's a really big name, obviously we get good numbers because people want to hear from famous people. When we invite guests on who you may never have heard of before, it still makes no difference. We still get tens of thousands of downloads a day, hundreds of thousands of downloads a week. And for that, we just want to say thank you. Thank you for trusting us that we will only invite people onto this podcast who we know can give you amazing lessons to help transform your life. And you may not have heard of Steve Morgan, but trust me, by the end of today's episode, there'll be things that he's done in his incredibly successful life that will impact you. Here's what to expect.
I used to dread the winter because you've only got 8 hours of daylight in the winter, and thought of working an 8 hour day was just like, what do you do with the rest of your life? You know, it's just impossible. We all go through life with windows of opportunity. And the thing to do is to take them when you've got them. I mean, I had to think long and hard about it because it's counterintuitive. You work hard for all this money, and then at the stroke of a pen, you give literally £300 million away. You know, I hear about this work-life balance, and that's fine. And you can grow a career doing exactly that. But if you want to build a business, you've got to work. Nobody's going to do it for you. You've got to work.
Now, we recorded this episode with Steve after the outbreak of coronavirus. And you know what? In early 2020, he pledged £1 million a week to charities to help vulnerable members of society coping with the fallout of the virus. And his support was credited as a lifeline for hundreds of charities, particularly food banks, support for homeless charities, domestic abuse and mental health organisations. And his foundation reported in December 2020, he'd given over £27 million to charities impacted by COVID-19. As well as that, he's personally donated hundreds of millions of pounds to charity. This is a guy who's been incredibly successful, but as you're about to hear over the next hour, he has never forgotten his roots. I really hope you enjoy today's episode of the High Performance Podcast. It comes next. Before we get going with today's episode, let me just tell you what I'm up to with Lotus Cars this week. As you know, they're our founding partner. You may also know that I'm involved in a charity here in Norfolk called the Community Sport Foundation, and the kindness of Lotus is remarkable. They gave us at the charity a Lotus Elise Sport 240 Final Edition, the first one off the production line, and we then sold tickets for £9 each, and the first name out of the hat was going to win the car. We raised £100,000 for the Community Sport Foundation. And this week I will go down to Hethel and I will be giving the car to Alex Juggins, who was the winner, whose name was drawn out of the hat. That's not bad, is it? A Lotus Elise for £9. But it's just another example of a high performing company not only excelling in their area of expertise, but also committing their time and energy to working with the community, to understanding the importance of the Community Sport Foundation. And their work absolutely highlights the key aspects of a high-performing company, including kindness. I think sometimes we can forget how important that is. Thanks so much, Lotus, and you should follow them at Lotus Cars.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A Hi there, I'm Jake Humphrey. You're listening to High Performance, the podcast that delves into the minds of the most successful athletes, visionaries, entrepreneurs and artists on the planet, aims to unlock the very secrets to their high performance life so you can follow in their footsteps. With me as ever, lecturer, author, Professor Damien Hughes. And Damien, I think today's guest epitomises not just high performance, but also a high level of empathy and understanding.
Definitely, Jake. I think what I'm really looking forward to exploring today's guest with is not only his success in his chosen domain, but the reinvention of himself to want to give back. And to, there's an old saying that, you know, a sign of a healthy society is how we help the more vulnerable. And this person has got that empathy to do that.
Okay, let's explain some more then and find out the tricks, the behaviours, the mindset and the belief required to take a small building firm into a FTSE 250 business, the bravery to then step down as chairman and then to return and save the struggling firm, the ambitious mindset that led to our guest trying to buy Liverpool Football Club, who he supported as a boy, and eventually acquiring Wolverhampton Wanderers and helping take them into the Premier League. Yet through all these business deals, maintaining an empathy and an emotional connection to the city from where he came from that has led to him giving over £300 million to charity through his own foundation. What a fascinating life. So how has he done it and what can you learn from him? Welcome to the podcast, Steve Morgan.
Good morning.
Nice to have you with us.
Lovely to be here.
What is high performance?
I think high performance really is different things to different people. For me, I don't think I'm particularly skilled at anything, so I have to do it with endeavour. So I think hard work, I've always been hard working. Even as a kid, I did two paper rounds, worked every single school holiday. I just always worked. So graft to me is probably the individual one. And my wife always says to me that I've got more drive. It just everything I do to the absolute ultimate. And I think so. Drive and hard work for me. Other people can do it with skill as well. I'm probably lacking in that part. But
what's great there, though, is for people listening to this who think there's a secret to living a high performance life or a secret to achieving what you really want. And I will go on to talk about the dreams you had as a boy that you did manage to achieve. The great thing about what you've just said is that if it is drive and desire and will and effort and graft and heart, anyone can do it.
Literally anyone can do it. When I started Red Row, it was on a sewer contract and I was down in the trenches, laying the drains myself, driving the JCB, laying the concrete. It wasn't a glamorous start. And to my mind, I did it and did it, tried to do it better than anybody else. And first 5 years, I made all the business was laying sewers. So it's not the most glamorous of starts, but I think every day I got up, I used to start work from 7 till 7, 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, and always had the appetite and the hunger to want to do more.
But you also had the ambition, because there'll be lots of people that would have started a business laying sewer pipes. They would have worked incredibly hard at it and they would have had hard graft for 50, 60 years and retired laying sewer pipes. What was it about you, or where had the seeds been sown where you were thinking, well, this is fine for now, but my ambitions are grand?
I think, you know, you have luck on the way. And my piece of luck was actually Margaret Thatcher. She came into power, and by that time we'd gone on to do some building works, contracting mainly, and built a few council houses and housing association properties. But when Margaret Thatcher came in, she put an axe through public spending and made us look elsewhere, and that was my lucky break.
Yeah, but you capitalised on it. That same thing happened to many people who didn't do what you've then done. So is it only luck?
Well, I think it was. What it did is it forced a change, and I'm delighted that it forced a change. So at the time, I cursed the policies that she introduced, but with hindsight, it was the best thing that ever happened to me. It was really made me find myself, because instead of being told what to do as a contractor and these are the plans and that's the price and you've got to get on with it, I was able to go and choose the piece of land we were buying, to design what was on there, and gave me I didn't realise I had a creative side. I got thrown out of art classes at a very early age. I'm useless at art. But I found that I had a creativity, and built in Red Row the best brand in the housing market and the most desired brand in the housing market. And that's come from my desire to always want to do better. When we build a great house, I'm going through, I'm a pain in the backside, I'm going through it. Now, that plug socket needs to be a foot closer to there to help, you know, to because it'd suit better. The light switch, let's move it around. I went into every last detail. It showed me that I actually did have some creativity in me, but it was a lucky break that got me there.
So can I take you back to your origins in many ways, Steve, on this? Because we're in a city in Liverpool where famously Paul McCartney tells a story that he went to school for years and nobody ever knew that he could sing. So he never made the school choir because nobody had recognised that he had that talent or that interest. And you speak about you discovered relatively late after education that you had this creativity. Would you tell us a little bit about your background then in terms of this hard work, this drive, where it came from?
You know, we always talk about nature or nurture. I think in my case, it's predominantly nature. I had a fairly tough upbringing as a kid. My father was in the RAF, in National Service, and met my mum, who was only 17 at the time, and my mum was only 18 when I was born. So they clearly had no money whatsoever. So we lived in a two up, two down in under the bridge in Garston. We didn't have electric, we didn't have toilets. And it was, in fact, I was 7 years old before I knew what an inside toilet was. I went to 9 different schools. I lived in 9 different houses before I was 16. I was constantly new kid on the block. And I think, you know, it's quite tough being new kid on the block when you don't know anybody. And I was there many, many times. And
was that because your dad was in the forces?
No, he left the forces when I was about 4 years old. But he, first of all, we were living with my grandparents, so they understandably wanted to get out of there. We went to live in a caravan. The Caligas bottle kept failing, so that meant no light because you had these little wick candle things. But I can remember all those things. And I think, looking back, it was probably the fact that I constantly had to adapt as a kid. You know, going to 9 different schools is... You know, in Liverpool, it's a tough city. It's a great city, but it's a tough city, and everybody wants to try the new boy out, don't they? And you know, it kind of toughens you up. You fight or flight, and I've always done the former.
Is that where your resilience was formed, do you think?
I think it helped. I think it definitely helped. You constantly had to be on your wits as the new kid, and as I say, the new kid, everybody wants to try the new kid out. And there wasn't many new kids, actually, in those days, because there wasn't the same mobility. So it definitely did. It certainly made me not afraid of anything. Yeah. And I think that has helped me in my later life.
So do you see any sort of pattern of, even unconsciously, the fact that you made your career by building solid foundations for families with homes, and yet you lived such a nomadic existence for the first 16 years?
Maybe subliminally, but I enjoy housing. I really enjoy it. I left in Redrow in 2000. I went back in 2009 to save the company from going under. I left 18 months ago, and guess what? About 3 weeks ago, I bought another house building company. So I guess I can't keep out of it, really. I think I'm really... I think it's very much in the blood. So it could well be, Damien, maybe that is subliminally there, and not consciously, though.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
Let's discuss Redrow, then. You started this by describing luck that came your way. You're only going to make good use of any luck with lots of hard work. For people listening to this that want to set their own businesses up, or maybe already run their own businesses and are struggling somewhat, can you give us an insight into the hard work and the sacrifice from you and I guess your partner at that time, and how hard it was?
It was very hard because I started Redrow in November 74. I was only 21 myself, and I was as green as grass, you know, absolutely didn't have a bloody
clue. Can
that
not be helpful sometimes, that naivety?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. It can be helpful because you're not afraid of anything, and I wasn't afraid of anything anyway because I didn't have anything, so I had nothing to lose. And my father helped me out with some finances, basically to pay the wages until we got a draw from the contract, and then to buy materials. And of course, as a new kid, nobody would give you credit, so you had to buy everything cash on delivery and everything. That helped me out, and I got through it, really tore through it, and then realized at the end of it I had no work. I had a few guys with me and no work. And anyway, the company I was working for previously, whose contract it was that I did it as a subcontract for, said, oh, actually, we've got other jobs we need finishing off. So they kept me going for a couple of years until such time as I got other contract work. But I think it was more naivety. I never knew anything other than hard work. I never knew anything other than getting up at 5, 6 o'clock in the morning and getting out of the house and being on site for 7 and working all the daylight hours. I used to dread the winter because you've only got 8 hours of daylight in the winter, and thought of working an 8-hour day was just like, what do you do with the rest of your life? You know, it's just impossible. I think it was tough on my first two kids from my first marriage because I didn't see them.
And how old were you when you had them?
25 when I had my...
So you'd really only just started, the business was in its infancy.
Yeah, the business was very much in its infancy. We're still very much contracting, civil engineering contracting at the time. And then 2 years later, my daughter was born. So they hardly saw me as a kid until 1991, 92, when I took them out of school and went around the world for 6 months, took a sabbatical. And
what prompted that?
Well, at the time, Red Road now become quite a successful house builder, still a private company. And I'd seen the recession coming, but that time we'd expanded into the southeast of England, and the southeast of England was going crazy. Nigel Lawson had put an end in double Mira's relief, which had caused a mini boom in the housing market. Well, not a mini boom, it was a massive boom, actually. And house price inflation went to 25% overnight. And I looked at this. We couldn't get labour to work because prices were going up almost by the day. The north of England was nothing like this, and the rest of the business was behaving fairly normally. But it's the southeast that was on a huge regional boom. And I said, this is unsustainable, sold out in the southeast. So that took the company back into cash in the bank. So when the recession started to bite in 89, 90, we were sat there with money in the bank, ticking over nicely because the north kept going, and we were well established in the north of England. And by 91, I was bored, completely bored out of my brains, because although the recession was really it probably at its peak, land prices were still far too high, so you couldn't buy land. We had enough land in the north of England, so the thrill for me is doing the deals, and there was no deals to be done. So I was getting up in the morning, and what are we doing? And, oh, yes, we're going to build some more houses today. And for me, that's no challenge at all. I need to be doing better and better and better. And I was bored out of my brain. So we had one rainy Sunday morning in probably about March time, and I said to Pam, my wife, I said, I can't, it's just driving me nuts, this. I'm not busy enough. I said, how do you fancy going around the world? And she said, you've had, how much you drank?
So money wasn't your driver because the business was doing well.
The business was doing very well. I was boredom was my driver.
Right. So money didn't give you enough of a thrill. You need more in your life.
No, there was nothing to do, because in recessions, even a recession has a cycle. First of all, it's firefighting everywhere, and then it goes flat, and people don't realise that there's a new reality here. And then when people do realise a new reality, things like in our game, house prices drop, land prices drop tremendously, then all of a sudden it gets exciting again, and then you gear up for the Phoenix, really, for coming out. But all through, we traded, we were making money, we were making very good money, but we weren't expanding. And without expanding, that was no use to me. So I said, I know I've had a couple of glasses of wine, but I said, but we're doing it. And so for the next 3 months, I planned a trip. We went to 22 different countries around the world. Don't forget, it was pre-mobile phones and everything, pre-internet. So we had to plan everything meticulously, because we went to places
We didn't go to the tourist places. We went to places that nobody had ever seen. We were one of the first tourists back into Beijing following the Tiananmen Square massacre. Okay. My kids were the first kids ever to go overland from Tibet. We went right through Tibet, through to Nepal.
Why did you want to do this with your children?
To give them something that they could never get in their life. I was with my daughter this week. It was her 40th birthday this week, and she still talks about that world trip.
Gives me goosebumps.
They both had birthdays on the trip, their 10th birthday and their 12th birthday, respectively, and they still talk about it. And I made them write the quid pro quo for me was I always... The kids were brilliant at mental arithmetic because wherever we were, I'd be throwing them questions all the time. And they had to write a daily diary. That was the deal.
Non-negotiable.
Non-negotiable, wherever you were. And we used to have these Lonely Planet books. And they would say, right, this is where we're going today. And so let's do some research about it and do the history. And they had to write a minimum of 2 pages. And my eldest lad got cute and his writing just became bigger. So I said, no, that's now 3 pages if you want to do that. So it was 2 pages of diary writing per day. And they hated it at first, but actually they really got into it. And those diaries became something that they look back on in later life.
See, what fascinates me about that, Steve, is that given the busy, frenetic life that you'd led up to then, this sounds to me like this is one of the first times that you've learned to put your foot on the ball and slow down. What did that period give you?
Well, we didn't slow down. We did it at 1,000 miles an hour.
But what did that period give you, though? So whilst it maybe wasn't a change of pace, what did you learn about yourself in that period?
Well, I think the most important thing it gave me was a catch-up with my kids. It was great fun to spend 6 months 24/7 with them and to have adventure. You know, it was an adventure that I'm pleased to say no other kids really have done.
Well, you couldn't do it today, even if you wanted to.
You couldn't do it today, and it would be so different today because the bloody mobile phones going and, you know, and the internet. We were lucky. I'm so pleased that we did it at a time when there was no phones and there was no internet.
Yeah.
Because it... Looking back, it really added something.
We've only been speaking for a short amount of time, but I think already I'm getting the impression that you're not someone who spends his life waiting for the perfect moment to make a decision. And I've got lots of friends around me where I say, oh, you should be doing this. And they say, oh, I don't think it's the right time. And it's whether you set your own business up at 21, whether it's having kids when you've got a fledgling business that's only 4 years old, whether it's making the decision to change the way your business operates because of an incoming recession, whether it's just disappearing off around the world for 6 months. You don't seem to me like someone who overthinks or waits for the perfect moment to do something. You just decide it feels right and you go for it. Is that fair?
I've always, always been counterintuitive. So when the herd are going one way, I'll probably be one of the forefront of that herd at the beginning. And then at a point where there's too many people following that, let's have a look back. And frequently I'll do the complete opposite. I was the only house builder that sold out in the southeast in 88, the only one. In fact, there was I remember a newspaper article in the Express where the journalist said that Morgan's taken his bat and ball home to the north because he can't stand the heat in the southeast kitchen. You arsehole. Sorry, I'm just saying something. I remember seeing that same journalist years later and I said, do you remember that article you wrote? And he said, I do. And he wrote a retraction in fairness to him. But in 93, I went back into the southeast and bought Costain Homes when everybody else was going bust. By the time, remember I said before about the way cycles work, and if you wait for things to happen, you've missed the boat. Really, you've missed it too late. You've got to be there in front. So I went back in. We bought Costain Homes. We'd just lost £100 million.
Yeah.
Over the previous 3 years, picked it up at a song, and that was Redrow back in the southeast again.
So what are your tools that you employ to make those kinds of decisions? Because that's quite scary to buy a business that's lost £100 million, and that's why lots of people wouldn't do it. What processes do you go through?
I like to think that I weigh things up. I had a discussion with my ex-colleagues at Redrow, who were very, very cautious during this pandemic. And I understand why they were reluctant to open up again after lockdown. I didn't have a fallout with them, but I had a certainly different views. And I said, guys, get out there, start building. The sales will be there. And nobody believed me. And had I been at Redrow, we'd have started work 6 weeks before they actually did. I was completely right. The housing market is actually quite strong at the moment. I wouldn't have bought McBride Homes 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, if I hadn't thought that the housing market was strong, because this recession that we're in now is about a pandemic. It's not about economic conditions. Many people have suffered badly in this, and if you're in the leisure industry and the travel industry, oh my God, you're having a torrid time at the minute. I know, because I've got Cardin Park Hotel, and we're fighting it all the time. But if you're not, you know, people were furloughed. They were on 80% of the money, but they weren't commuting backwards and forwards. They weren't going out to pubs, restaurants, spending money. They weren't going on foreign holidays. Lots of people are actually better off. And if you think about it logically, you say, well, actually, why wouldn't the housing market be good? You've got virtually nil interest rates. Mortgage payments have never been lower. Why wouldn't it? And there's massive demand. I mean, the country needs millions of new homes. So why wouldn't the housing market be good? And it is.
See, what fascinates me about your answer here, Steve, is that you obviously see a bigger picture. So you talk about these patterns or these cycles that you describe. So if somebody was listening to this, how do they gain perspective to be able to look at the big picture and see these patterns rather than get stuck in the moment and find themselves being reactive and responsive to events?
Maybe this does go back to my childhood. I've never really thought about it. But when, as a kid, I was thrown into circumstances, I used to say, I'm not afraid of this. We're just going to have to have a go. And that includes many a scrape on the streets. You just have a go. You just get stuck in. So I think when you're in these situations, you just got to think it through. Just think it through. And then I always think, follow your conviction. If you believe in yourself, just do it.
I've heard it described, the three eyes of a business analyst describe it as, there's some people that are initiators, some that are imitators, and then there's the idiots that follow. And it sounds very much that you're in that first initiator bit. You make things happen by stepping back and looking at patterns before you then commit fully.
Well, it's funny you should say that, Damien, because I always think in the past when the property guys, i.e. the commercial property guys, start getting into housing, then you know it's time to get out.
Can we talk about your brother who passed away in a motorcycle accident?
Yeah.
How much did that reframe your perspective on life?
It completely changed my life. You know, I'm not a religious person, but my look totally changed when Jimmy died. We were really short of work. And as I say, I'm not a person that can sit still at all. I've always got to be doing something. And I didn't have enough work. And that was in 1977. And so I decided, I bought some Rolls Royces, actually, old ones, old bangers, and the pounds to the dollar was almost 1-to-1. And you know what? I can sell these out in America for twice the price, and literally they were double the price out in America. So I thought, well, I'll go out there. I went out to America, went to California, really loved it. I thought, looked at what they were doing out there, and I thought, you know what? We can seriously do some damage out here. And so Pam and I decided to emigrate to California. I'm not qualified at anything, so I couldn't get a visa, but she could, because she was an SRN, she was a trained nurse. She had a job lined up, we were all set to go, and then tragically my brother got killed in a motorbike accident. He was only 17. He went to pick up his pal from work, and a car pulled out in front of him, and that was that. My mum was just going through a divorce with my dad at the time,
was just beside herself, almost suicidal, really. She was completely beside herself. Jimmy was the only one, last one living at home. My sister had already married and gone. I'd already gone. And we said, you know, we can't do this. We're going to have to stay because I just can't leave her. And again, it was one of those lucky breaks for me, because to me, it was like Jimmy pulling the strings from heaven, because my luck completely changed almost on the spot. We got a contract, and there was no contracts around. We got a £40,000 contract to put a footpath right round the Great Orme in Llandudno. Now, 40,000 doesn't sound like a lot of money today, but in those days for us, it was a massive, massive job. And that saw us through the winter. And then the work just kept coming in. And also, the decision not to go to California, we decided to start a family. So 9 months later, literally 10 months after Jimmy died, my eldest son was born. Wow. So it was life-changing. So from tragedy, something really good happened. But most of all, as I said, it was like Jimmy pulling strings, because literally the work started flooding in.
Do you still feel that's happening? Is it something you've carried with you?
I don't sort of think a bit of luck and say, well, that's Jimmy doing it again. But, you know, I do thank my lucky stars, really, that I have had lucky opportunities in my life. But in saying that, I think opportunities are like windows. And there's too many people walk past windows with blinked eyes and don't see them, don't see the window of opportunity.
That's what I find interesting. You talk about luck. You must have mentioned luck or lucky 20 times. These opportunities appear for everyone. The people that don't take them are the people that don't have the frame of mind that the opportunity is there. You're not lucky. You're an opportunity finder.
And that's, I think we all go through life with windows of opportunity. And the thing to do is to take them when you've got them.
How do people see them? People that don't see opportunities at the moment, how do you reframe your thinking to see an opportunity? Is it basically being an optimist?
I think believing in yourself is very important.
What's your self-belief like?
I'm not cocky at all in the sense that I believe in following my instinct, but in many ways I don't believe in myself at all. I'm rubbish at most things, really, but if I see something that I'm willing to go, I absolutely follow it. And by the way, I've got a few wrong on the way. I had a big investment in Eastern Europe when I was out of Red between 2000 and 2009, from about 2005, 6, 7. And oh my God, I got my fingers burnt. And, you know, that cost me a lot of money. So I've had my cock-ups on the way.
It doesn't stop you from doing it again?
No, stick to your knitting. I think it's one of my sayings, stick to your knitting. And actually what made me think I could go to places like Turkey and Romania and Poland and outsmart the locals. You know, I didn't. I got a good thick ear, and you know, you got to learn from that.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, I just want to talk to you very briefly about what I believe to be a total revolution in sleep, and it's called 8Sleep. It's a pod cover that goes on the mattress that's currently on your bed, and it controls the temperature to suit you perfectly. And it all works from this app. Me and my wife, we like different temperatures. I actually like my side of the bed cooler. But the 8Sleep isn't just about the temperature. It's your own personal sleep coach. I get a sleep fitness score. I can find out more about the quality of my sleep, the kind of routine that I'm in. But it also gives me the different sleep stages as well, so I can find out how much REM sleep or deep sleep I'm getting. And then I can tailor things in my own life, like alcohol or coffee before bed or when I work out, to try and improve my sleep. And we all know that sleep is the foundation of high performance. If we can improve our sleep, we can improve so much of our life. It's time to bring tech to the bedroom by going to 8sleep.com/HPP, where you can get £200 off your pod and free shipping. That's 8sleep.com/HPP.
Today's show is brought to you in association with Mindlift, the most personalized brain training app that can help improve your focus and your relaxation. So Mindlift is neuroscience based. And what I love about Mindlift, I've been using it for a while now, is that it's totally personalized to me. So if you're interested in optimizing your health, I would recommend you check out Mindlift. And don't just take my word for it. Take the word of the elite athletes and the industry leaders who use it. So Mindlift accesses brain sensing technology, games and videos that correspond to your brain's activity. Honestly, it's fascinating. You wear a smart headband which measures your brain activity and gets you a personalized routine to sharpen your mental fitness. I've been using it first thing in the morning, and genuinely, when I go into early meetings or I've got lots happening in a day, I notice the difference. I'd love you to start your personalized program at mindlift.com/high performance, and you will get $40 off your first subscription. That's mindlift.com/high performance.
The stuff around Jimmy's death really fascinates me because of how you frame what Jake was asking around there about that optimism. And do you think there was something around a sense of perspective that it gave you, that, you know, to see your brother pass away at 17, do you think it shaped your view of the world, of these opportunities? You saw the life that he could have had and the opportunities that he had, and it just opened your eyes to those opportunities that were out there, like building the footpath and the contracts. Well,
it shocked me to the foundations, actually. It shocked the whole family, because, you know, 17-year-old, saw him earlier on the day, you know, I waved to him and he pulled tongues at me. And, you know, the shock of something like that coming right out of the blue completely was a reality check for me, because, I was only 24 myself, and I can still remember and feel the shock of it all today. And it was a huge reality check. And I think it did make me think. I certainly... The decision not to move to California, we took within a month of his death, and it was the right thing to do. And as I say, it was Jimmy, I think, pulling strings and changing it for us.
Can we talk about your involvement in football?
Yeah.
You talk about stick to your knitting. Yeah. Sticking to your knitting is not trying to buy Liverpool Football Club, is it?
No, it's not. You're quite right. No, even I can break my own rules. But I think I've got that stick to the knitting by breaking my own rules and seeing that, I can't necessarily transfer skills.
What I love about this story is you grew up in Liverpool. It's your city. Liverpool Football Club is your football club. The ambition to just say, I'm going to buy it. I want to go and buy that football club. I love that. It comes back to the way you've lived your whole life, which is blue sky, big thinking, right?
Yeah.
Why didn't it happen?
Well, it nearly did. Very nearly did. The truth has never come out about what actually happened. I tried to buy it for a couple of years before we eventually did strike a deal, which was the summer of 2004. And the deal was not to buy, it was to buy a controlling interest of it. It was 51%. And the deal was £70 million for 51%. So it valued the club at £140 million. And if you look on Wikipedia today, it says I tried to buy the club for 60. It was just rubbish. Mm. It was 70, and that was split between £35 million for existing shareholders and £35 million cash injection into the club, because the club was in major debt. And people have said to me, that doesn't sound like a lot of money. At the time, the turnover was just 100 million. The losses were 22 million that year. The club was in big debt. Sky, or the TV money, was about 30 million. And so with the crystal ball, you'd say, you know, why didn't you go ahead and do the deal? But when we were told at the start of the deal, the losses were going to be about 5 million or so this year. So we weren't expecting it to be great. With due diligence, it was 22 million, not 5. Big difference. Plus, there was capitalization of spend on the new stadium, which never transpired, but it was more money going on. So at the end of it, I said, well, we'll still do the deal. We'll still do 51%, and we'll still do the 70 million. But I said, to me, the club needs more money, needs more cash, and I can't afford any more than 70 million. So the deal was changed to 50 million to go into the club, and so 20 million to the existing shareholders, because the club needed the money, needed the investment. And anyway, the existing shareholders refused to change the deal, even though that the due diligence gave us the reality, something very different to what was presented when we effectively shook hands on it. So that's why it didn't go ahead.
Interesting.
But you speak about that you follow your instincts, and a lot of it is about logic, and yet the numbers that you're presenting there, Steve, would scream to walk away from a deal like that. So what was the driver to want to keep?
As you quite rightly say, Damien, Liverpool Football Club was the club I, almost from the day I could talk, was a club I supported. So it was passionate to me. And I also was probably arrogant enough to think that I could change it round, but that's why I needed the 50 million in the club. I felt we could change it. They needed some new players. Rafa Benitez had just been appointed before me. But I think Rafa Benitez was probably the right man for the time. And, you know, later, a year later, when Istanbul happened, he proved that he was the right man for the job. And there were some fantastic young players on the side, none better than Stevie Gerrard, who was just a phenomenal player. But they also had some real duffers in there, high pressure signings, high cost signings that actually needed to be got out of the club, and knew it was going to cost, and that was more losses to come. But that's why I felt the club needed 50 million, not 35 million, to get it forward. And I think, you know, had the deal been done, I would have gone forward very happily, and God only knows what the history of Liverpool Football Club would have looked like. I'll never know. Nobody will ever know what would happen.
Do you allow regret into your life? Because what I find interesting about this, if it was, you've just bought another house building company, if you, that wasn't a heart decision, that was a head decision.
Mm.
Buying Liverpool was a heart decision, not a head decision. So when it doesn't happen, do you allow yourself to even now sit there and think, oh, I could have bought that club, could have done this, could have done that? Or is that just wasted energy?
Jake, that's not something I ever do. That's one of my philosophies in life. Move on. Move on from good things and bad things. You have to move on. Never look back. Don't look in the rearview mirror.
You learn first from
that? Oh, you learn. I think you've got to learn. What did I take home from that deal? It was the one that got away. You know, had you had a crystal ball and know that within just a few years, the TV money was going to multiply. But I didn't know it was. I was looking at tens of millions of losses in the club. Had you know that the sponsorship and commercial deals and worldwide TV rights, etc., were coming down the corridor, of course you'd have done the deal. I never looked back on success either, because my philosophy, when we do something, we really have a great year, say, well, yeah, we've got to beat that next year, and you just got to keep going.
Do you still enjoy it, though? You take time to enjoy the successes or not?
I enjoy success. I enjoy the success of Redrow. I enjoy the success of creating more for the shareholders. One of the most fascinating things for me was the year before I left Redrow, my last year, we built our 100,000th house, which if you take an average, you know, about 3.2 people per house, bearing in mind we build family houses mainly, it's equivalent to a city the size of Nottingham or Newcastle. I did allow myself to say, you know what, bugger, you know, well done. And I never say that.
The lad that grew up in a house without a toilet has built 100,000 of them.
Built a city the size of Newcastle. I took a great deal of pride in just that achievement. But generally, I don't look back. I look forward.
And football did come your way through Wolverhampton Wanderers.
Yeah.
Why did you want to do that then? Because you didn't support them?
Well, funnily enough, as a kid, when everything was black and white, TV was black and white and newspapers were black and white, to see the colours of kits which you only saw it actually on bubblegum cards. And I always used to think that the Wolves kit, I loved the kit colour, you know, and the name as a kid, when you're sort of 6, 7, 8 years old, Wolves, and Wolves were right up there the top. And I said, wow, that's a great thing. And the logo with the wolf head, and, you know, as a 7 year old, it's very impressionable. So it was always my second team. I always looked out for it. So I spent my whole life always looking at second result was always Wolves. And then I went there to a match. I was invited to a match, and I got pounced upon by the Wolves directors, and they said, you've got to buy this club. I know you didn't buy Liverpool. You've got to buy this club. Now, I'd been approached by 15 different clubs after the Liverpool deal fell away, which I won't name, but many of them are in the Premier League right now. But I didn't have the interest in going to them. But Wolves, I thought, you know what? Where I live, I'm only an hour away from the ground. It's always been my soft team. And the deal was very good. I mean, the deal was buy the club for £10.
Was this from Jack Hayward and his family?
It was Jack Hayward, yeah. It was a lovely, lovely guy. But to put money in, he couldn't run the club, and he was looking for somebody. He had a very tight stipulation. He would only sell it to an English person who loved football and who could put money in. And I think I ticked those boxes. So I did the deal with Jack. And, yeah, I had 9 years at Wolves. Very interesting years indeed.
What did you learn most about running a football club?
It's bloody tough.
Because a lot of businessmen get into it,
yep,
and suddenly look like bad businessmen because it struggles. Why do people get it so wrong, and what did you learn?
Well, rightly or wrongly, I run the club as a business. The club had some debt, not huge, but it was certainly £6-7 million or something. But it didn't own its own ground. It didn't own the land around the ground. And as a property person, I think, and one of the leases literally had 2 or 3 years to go, and it, quite frankly, could have closed the club down if we didn't get it sorted. So I set about getting all the freehold around the ground, so the club now sits in a 12-acre freehold island. We didn't even have any lease on where the away coaches go. We just had a very loose agreement, so I had to get that sorted out. And I gave Mick McCarthy, who was the manager at the time, a purse to go and buy some players. We just missed out on promotion in my first season, but the second season we won the championship. We got in first position by the end of August and never lost it. We get all the way through the season and won the league comfortably, I think, by about 10 points. So that was us back in the Premier League, and that was Wolves had only been back in the Premier League once in the previous 30 years. It was great. It was fantastic. The optimism ran. And, you know, you think you walk on water the second season. Oh, yeah, we won. You get a reality check when you go in the Premier League, and then the agents come knocking on the door and demand increased wages for all the players. And the demands go ridiculous. And I think, oh, is this not a world I'm used to? But you have to get used to it pretty quick.
Do you know what I think is interesting about successful businessmen that buy football clubs, right? Is that you work hard on the business side of the football club. You just talked about buying the 12 acres and sorting out the coaches and looking after the stadium and the training ground, right? But that's not the sexy stuff.
No.
All people talk about with football is the players, the manager, the results, the performances, which you can't get involved in. That's the strange sort of dichotomy of being a businessman that owns a football club, the best bit, you get no access.
That's a really frustrating bit, I can tell you. And on the whole, I did leave it to the manager, although I always had a healthy relationship with the managers and talked to them all the time. And the chief exec there, I was on the phone with, you know, 4 or 5 times a week about buying players, selling players, etc. So I was very, very heavily involved with it. And I had the business, I had Wolves for 9 years. And over the 9 years, and when we had years when we made profits, we had years when we made losses, but over a 9-year view, we didn't lose any money. And I was able to buy all the land back in, build a new stand, build an academy, which is as good as any in the Premier League. So I was very proud of that achievement. But Jake, what you said is completely right. The fans want to see results on the pitch, and if you're not spending money all the time, then the fans are not happy. And we had 3 years in the Premier League, which is, as I said, was much longer than they'd had over the previous 30-odd years. I did two bad appointments as managers, and we had a double relegation down to League One, and that was a real tough time, and with the fans, etc. And then I had one of the most enjoyable years I've ever had involved in football, and that was when we were in League One. And we hammered everybody. We literally hammered everybody and won the league with 103 points, which I think was the record. And it was fantastic going home every Saturday, having won 3-4, 5-1 or something. And
so we've had some coaches on here, whether these are young coaches like Frank Lampard or Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, or some more experienced coaches like Sean Wayne from Rugby League. And one of the common themes that come out in our discussions is the need to manage upwards, to speak to the decision makers and get time and patience. Now, as the guy that is making those decisions, can you give us some insight that those coaches could have of how can they manage upwards effectively? How could a coach make sure that you're on board with what they're trying to do to give them the air cover and the space and time to be able to implement their ideas?
What we did right from the onset is decide how we were going to run Wolves. Now, I was never going to put bottomless amounts of money in to the club as an investment. So we had to be smart. And for me, the idea of being smart was to grow your own. And there have been plenty of successful clubs who've done well by doing that. One of the early things that we did was to strongly enhance the academy, but we also had some close relationships with smaller clubs who, when there was a bright young star coming through them, there was a further budget to buy in 15, 16-year-olds and bring them into the... Matt Doherty was one who's just been sold to Spurs, but we signed Matt as a 16-year-old. So that was my way forward. Now, we sat down with the manager at the time, and we used to probably have dinner together once a month.
So it's regular dialogue?
Regular dialogue, absolutely regular dialogue, yeah. For me, that's the only way it works. I think other people have different views and they can make it work for them. But for us, it was a team effort. And I always think, actually, having communication is so important, whatever you're doing in life, and communicating what your plans are for the team and getting everybody to buy into that, I think, is massively important.
Not just in football, but in business as well. How do you deal with or make the decision to let certain people go, and then how do you make sure you bring the right people into your businesses, into your life?
Do you know, that's one of the hardest things you can do. I remember... early days of Redrow, having a buyer who we'd never had a buyer. I did all the buying, and we were growing literally 100% per annum at one stage. I remember bringing in a buyer and thinking, wow, this guy really knows what he's doing. He produced wonderful schedules, which I never did. It was brought in a professionalism to the business. Wow, that's great. And then 2 years later, we doubled and then doubled again. He'd had to bring in an assistant and then another buyer as well, so we were growing so fast. And then I suddenly realised this guy who I was very fond of was actually not a number one. He would have been a very good number two, but his number two we brought in was much more efficient than he was. And it was one of my lessons about over-promoting somebody, because our chief buyer was actually not our best buyer at all. And I had to have a very painful conversation with him, which I can still remember to this day. It really taught me a lesson about over-promoting people, and when you make a mistake, you've got to deal with it. As soon as you realise you've made a mistake, that you just get on and deal with it. Ditto with football and the managers. You know, Mick did a great job for the club, but I think was definitely lost it with the fans, and I think the final straw, we lost 5-1 at home to West Brom. Well, that's like Liverpool losing 5-1 at home to Manchester United. You know, it's the Holy Grail. You cannot do that. And so we had to have that very sad conversation, but it had, you know, it was the right thing to do, and no regrets about doing it. But yeah, you've got to stand up to reality, really.
And my other question about that period is about external validation. I often feel sorry for owners of football clubs, because when it goes well, credit the manager, credit the players. When it goes badly, get rid of the owner. Did it bother you that you put all that time, all that effort, all that money into Wolves, and then as soon as things go badly, people are just looking for the next owner, the next person to come and put money in? Or does that external validation from people not bother you?
Yes, I think it does bother me. You wouldn't be human if you said it didn't. And it did bother me, but it wasn't to the point where I was sort of losing sleep over it or anything. But I also, my life was changing. I'd just got together with my new girlfriend, who was now my wife, and my priorities were changing, I think, because of that, because I was well back in Redrow, and that was taking quite a bit of time, and I was thinking, well, you know what, I've done 9 years, have I done my bit, I've carried the baton through, I'm leaving the club in a much, much better position than where I found it. And it's been good fun, and time to move on, really.
Before we finish, I want to talk about your philanthropy. Making a lot of money is praiseworthy, but it kind of just happens if you run a successful business. Giving away a third of £1 billion to charity isn't something that just happens. That is a conscious decision. First of all, well done for having the mindset of giving £300 million to charity. I'm just so interested in why you've done that.
Again, it probably comes back to my roots. I've been very successful in life. I go to nice places. I live in a nice house and etc. But I never forgot where I grew up, and some of the kids I grew up with who had a different future in front of them. I think what got me into it probably in the first place was I got introduced to Alder Hey Hospital, who were trying to build a new oncology unit, and I said, well, you know, I'm going to help them with this. So I gave up my salary and bonuses in the 90s and put everything I earned into trying to fund this oncology unit. I ended up walking across.
Why was that? Did you have a personal connection to?
No, I just got introduced to it, and I went there and I met the team that ran it, and I saw some of the young kiddies who just gone through chemo and lost their hair, and it got to me. It completely got to me. I've got to help these kids out and any other kids that come along. And then the whole thing sort of got me thinking about my background and I've got to start giving something back in life. And I raised £1 million for Alder Hey back in the 90s. Did a Guinness Book of Records walk from Mediterranean to the Atlantic across the Pyrenees. Raised £360,000 for them. But then that sort of started a chain reaction. There was a young boy on the ward called George, and I took a pair of hobnail boots in for a photo opportunity, and it was a lovely photo of me and George in these sort of size 12 boots, not mine, by the way, which went on all the papers at the time. And I was very fond of little George, and he sadly died on... We were told literally as we were flying out to the Pyrenees to do the walk that he probably wouldn't be here by the time we got back, and it sort of broke my heart. We had a few rough days on that, particularly the first couple of days where we were up in several thousand metres up, and it was blizzarding and it was horrible cold, and George just got us all the way through it.
Amazing.
And not long after that, I left Redrow, and I felt, you know, I've got to set something up. I've got to set a foundation up to give him back. I put, I think, £5 million in at first, and the first few years were sort of tentative, and I thought, no, we can do better, and we got a team in, and a lady called Jane Harris who runs it to this day, who's fantastic, and I think the more we did, the more I realised that how much stuff needs doing, and one thing led to another, and Redrow's shares were doing very well. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to give 10% of the business, which was about a third of what I personally owned, to the charity.
And so we put these shares into the charity, and we're taking it from there, and we're spending it now. We were the first in COVID and lockdown to bring in an emergency fund to save other charities. We pledged £1 million a week to help keep other charities going. And a good deal of that was spent on Merseyside, but in Cheshire and North Wales as well, where we're from. And I get it. I work hard at the philanthropy now, in the same way I worked hard at Redrow. And we've just been recognised by the government, really. We've just been given some £10 million of match funding from the government. And I think we're the largest individual charity in the country to get this match funding. There was £75 million available, and we've got 10 of it. So, which means we can put an extra £20 million into charities in the Northwest to keep them going through this horrible period of the pandemic.
So can I ask you a question about it, Steve? Because this is something that often fascinates me, that you see people that have been incredibly successful and acquired great wealth and privilege, and then but keep going for it. And it's often like seeing somebody food shopping when they're hungry. They have to keep acquiring more and more. What was your mindset to say, I've got enough now and I want to give back? What was the moment or the catalyst or even the way of thinking that because what you're describing sounds so obvious outside of it, but it can't have been an easy decision to do what you've done.
You're quite right, Damien. It wasn't. I mean, I had to think long and hard about it because it's counterintuitive. You work hard for all this money, and then at the stroke of a pen, you give literally £300 million away. But I thought, well, you know, I don't need that money. My kids will be left enough. So nobody's going to starve in the Morgan family, but there are plenty of other people out there that will and that need it. So, as I say, I always work hard. I still do work hard, but I don't work hard for the money. I work hard because I like it.
I think before we move on to our final quickfire questions, a quick mention about work ethic. You're 68 years old. You've just bought a new building firm. 67 years old. 67 years old. Fight for those extra years at this point. 67 years old. Just bought a new building firm. You've made money, given money away, bought football clubs, sold football clubs. You've packed so much in. How much has hard work been at the very centre of all of these achievements? I hear rumours about 10,000 steps before breakfast.
Yeah, dude, we got a lockdown puppy, and so me and him do our 10,000 steps before breakfast every day. Yeah. I think your brain's a muscle, and like any muscle, use it or lose it. So to me, I hope I have the ability to be using that particular muscle till the day they put me in the box, and that's it, really.
Very good. Right, we have quickfire questions. Go for it, Damien.
Steve, what are the three non-negotiable behaviours that you and the people around you must buy into?
Smoking was number one, because I banned smoking in our Redrow offices in the 80s, way before it became law. I detest smoking. Liars and thieves, I cannot abide. For me, anybody who lies has got no future with me, and anybody who steals is out. And I suppose laziness is the third one. I think if you're lazy, you've got what's coming to you.
What advice would you give to a teenage Steve just starting out on his journey?
I think I'd say to him, what do you want? If you want to grow a business and be successful, there's only one formula, and that's you've got to work like hell. You know, if there was a commandment, it'll be thou shalt work like hell. You know, I hear about this work-life balance, and that's fine. And you can grow a career doing exactly that. But if you want to build a business, you've got to work. Nobody's going to do it for you. You've got to work.
How important is legacy to you?
I think legacy is massively important to me. And I thought about this question, and I thought, I had to deeply ask myself, and I think I came to the conclusion that it was massively important. 100,000 homes supporting 300,000 people live in a Redrow house, and I'm very proud of that. That's a legacy. The foundation will have huge funds in it when I eventually die, which hopefully not for a while yet. But we will have helped. We already have helped millions of people on the way. And, you know, to me, that's a legacy. And my children, you know, they're all different. There's five of them plus my stepson. And all six of them are completely different personality. But, you know, they're my legacy going forward as well. So I can come to the conclusion that it is massively important to me.
Are you happy?
Yes. I think, you know, you go through life and you have your blips and there are times where you want to kick the cat, and even though I've never had a cat. but, you know, we all have our moments, and, you know, this COVID situation is, you could get down on it, couldn't you? But, you know, you've got to keep attacking. And attack has always been my philosophy. And if you attack, for me, attacking is happiness, you know, and having a lovely wife and home life is very important to me.
And what's your one golden rule to live a high-performance life?
Back to my commandment, thou shalt work like hell if you want to. As I said right at the beginning, I don't think I've got any skills particularly, and I do mine through endeavour, and I'm driven. I drive myself to be happy as well. So it's driving hard work.
It's been an absolute pleasure to sit and chat to you for the last little while. We talk a lot on this podcast about fault versus responsibility and living a life where you don't look for blame and you don't attribute fault. You just take the responsibility. And I think you are the epitome of that. You know, it wasn't your fault that you were born into poverty, or your fault you lost your brother at a young age, or your fault that Margaret Thatcher put a sledgehammer through the trade you worked in, or your fault that Liverpool didn't come off, or any of these things. But every step of the way, you made it your responsibility to still, through sheer graft and bags of self-belief, to make a success out of your life. And what I love about that is that absolutely anyone can work hard and believe in themselves.
That's very true. Thank you.
Damien.
Jake.
The reason why I'm so inspired by talking to Steve is that I genuinely do believe there is no secret. Anyone could live the life that he's lived.
Yeah, definitely. What really moved me with him was the fact that his philanthropy work is, again, it was just the idea of just commitment, just put yourself out there and do it. Don't overthink it, but just put your money where your mouth is. And I think that trend is something that he did, from setting up his housing company at the age of 21 through to buying football clubs. He's just committed to doing something and then invested hard work behind it.
And he's also hugely modest. You know, he spoke about luck all the time, didn't he? But I honestly believe that everyone in life gets opportunities, but only certain people see the opportunity, and then only certain people who've seen the opportunity capitalise on the opportunity, and only certain people who capitalise on the opportunity work hard enough to make that opportunity a success, and he does all those things.
100%. I was reminded of some research from a guy called Dr. Richard Wiseman that wrote a book on this years ago called The Luck Factor, and that's his background in terms of he's a psychologist at Hertfordshire University. This was a huge social psychology study that said what he found is lucky people just believe that they're lucky, unlucky people believe that they're unlucky. So it's a mindset thing. So when you hear Steve talking about luck, as a definition from that, he sees opportunity, he takes risks, he gambles, just, and the phrase that he uses about luck is another term for just believing.
And because he thinks he's lucky, he then sees the opportunities.
Absolutely. So it's something around his identity. So when we hear it, and we've heard a lot of our guests talk about luck in that way, but the reality is it's a mindset that they look for opportunities, they look to get on the front foot, they commit when they do it. Whereas if you believe you're unlucky, you don't see these chances, you can find reasons to talk yourself out of it.
And the great thing about mindset is we're in control of it ourselves.
Absolutely.
Okay, it's that time of High Performance when Damien and I chat to a listener who's got in touch to tell us what they make of the way that the podcast has impacted their lives. And this is another direct message on Instagram. If you want to get in touch with us, Damien is at Liquid Thinker. I'm at Jake Humphrey, and the podcast is at High Performance. We see every message. You'll get a reply. We love to see the feedback. And Rick got in touch to say,
I just wanted to say thank you for creating the podcast. It's impacted me in so many ways and I'm so grateful. I've always found podcasts quite difficult to completely engage with my mind wandering and thinking about the tasks which I have to complete. However, this has never been the case with High Performance. I listen every morning on my way to work and it provides me with the focus I need for the day. I work as a GP in London. We're currently facing huge pressures and the recent negative media attention the profession has received has been very difficult to take. Again, your podcast has taught me there will always be people who don't like you or disagree with you. But if you focus on your values and your non-negotiables, then that's enough. I'm passionate about sharing the message with colleagues, so thanks again for what you're doing. And I'm really pleased to say that Rick joins us now. And if you are able to see rather than just hear this, you would know that Rick is sitting in his GP surgery in South London. Rick, thank you so much for joining us. And I hope we're not going to keep you from your patients for too long. But I think it's so important for people listening to this podcast to understand that, you know, there are real world benefits to something like high performance. I'm especially interested in this conversation around sort of negative criticism that we've all seen GPs have been getting in recent weeks, which is unfathomable for many of us. Which podcast episode or which lessons do you think really helped you to deal with the moment that you see that negativity? Because it's something that so many people struggle with.
Yeah, I think there's probably not one podcast that jumps out, but I think all of them. I think listening to stories from people from different kind of walks of life and people who are really high profile and the struggles that they faced in their own careers and how they dealt with those struggles. And at the heart of that is obviously that mindset and believing in yourself, even when others might not. And I think as a GP, as you've said, I think we're all doing, you know, not just GPs, but everyone else who I work with, we're doing our best in very difficult circumstances at the moment. And I think the sort of the attention that we've had recently has been really difficult to take. But I think listening to the podcasts day in, day out has taught me that as long as we focus on what we can do and doing our best, you know, I think that's all that matters. And if we do that, we will deliver sort of, you know, the best care we can to our patients.
Are there any other sort of skills or techniques, Rick, that you've picked up from our guests that you're able to apply into your practice?
Yeah, I mean, there are loads. So I think, and I can't remember which podcast I heard this on, but World Class Basics, that really struck a chord with me, because I think, you know, we've got loads of things that we have to do. But I think if you focus on the basics and you do those basics really, really well and try to do that day in, day out, I think, you're going to do your best for patients. I think attention to detail, really, really important, not cutting corners. And I think that these kind of lessons come out with, you know, a lot of the speakers that you've spoken to. And I think taking responsibility. As clinicians, we have a lot of responsibility. We get things wrong. We're human. But I think as long as, you know, if we take responsibility for our actions and learn from those mistakes and try to develop and grow, I think I hold on to those lessons day in, day out.
Brilliant. And for people that want to hear about World Class Basics, that was Sir Ian McGeachan, who was the former manager of the Lions, who came on and spoke to us about World Class Basics. I think what's interesting, Rick, is, you know, we live in a world now where people go to the GP a lot. What percentage of the people you see would you say present with mental or psychological problems rather than physical?
A huge amount. I would say the vast majority, and even those that present with a predominantly physical problem, actually, if you unpick that, there tends to be psychological issues at play. And actually, I've used the podcast with patients. I've signposted them to it because I just think it's fantastic. And I think it, you know, particularly when you're really struggling, to see that other people who you think, you know, you obviously see in, you know, on TV, and you think, you know, they've got it all sorted, and actually to hear that they've got their own struggles, I think is really powerful.
Well, look, Rick, thank you for getting in touch. Thank you for all you do on behalf of, you know, the people you've never met before, but walk into your surgery needing advice, needing help, needing support. I'm basically just going to tell people that the High Performance Podcast is being prescribed now.
Yeah, no, it is. It definitely is. Honestly, I try and get it in there as much as I can.
Oh, what an interesting conversation, Damien. And I think to hear a doctor talk about passing on the High Performance Podcast to his patients is brilliant. And I suppose it's a reminder, isn't it, that there are so many ways that we can improve our lives. And of course, you know, if you need to go to the doctor for a physical problem, absolutely you should do that. But, you know, think of all the times we've spoken to people on this podcast where they've said, I had to make a change to my lifestyle, which made a change to my mental health, which made a change to my entire life.
Yeah. I mean, Tyrone Mings is the guest that immediately jumps to mind on that, Jake, that when he spoke about he'd gone to Bournemouth, he was a Premier League player, and within a few minutes of his debut, he shattered his cruciate ligament. And he spoke about how he'd fallen into that trough of despair. And eventually it was about changing his lifestyle that facilitated his recovery and his eventual propulsion into the England team. So it wasn't about necessarily just getting fitter. It was about sort of looking at the influences around you. What were your habits? How was he refueling? It was all those factors that were just as significant as the physio sessions that he did.
And I think it's important to say that you don't have to, you know, hit a dark place, which is what Tyrone did, to realise the importance of those habits. You know, if you listen to Toto Wolff, good, strong, regular habits is what's made Mercedes the team they are. If you listen to Rick Lewis, the 12 defining principles of his business is what's made his business so successful. In almost every episode, it is the habits. It is the positive habits that have got people to high performance. And I think, you know, the fact that Rick just then came on and mentioned world-class basics from Ian McGeehan, that is the reminder that it doesn't have to be this huge leap in one direction, which is hard to get to and you're not sure where to go. It's just about basics, simple everyday things we all do, but doing those to the very, very best level we can. That is where you really will unlock the magic, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I think there's a guy called Vern Gambetta, he's like an athletic skills coach. And I listened to him years ago and he had a great line where he just said, too many people are looking for marginal gains without getting the basics right in the first place. Marginal gains is only when you've got the 99% basics nailed, then you can look for that extra little shortcut. But too many people want the extra shortcut without the basics being in place. And that's what we're hearing so often from our high-performing guests, that it's about nailing the basics, doing your job.
It reminds me of William McRaven, you know, the US military general. And by the way, if you want to hear William talking to us, you can do so on the High Performance Circle. He gave us an exclusive look into his life. You can find that at thehighperformancepodcast.com. But I remember in his speech when he said, if you make your bed every morning, you will have accomplished the first small task of the day, which then will give you a sense of pride, which then encourages you to do another task and another and another. And even then, if you have a bad day and a miserable day, you come home and your bed is made, and that made bed gives you the encouragement that tomorrow is going to be better. And that, I think that's the best example, because what making your bed, and people will be listening to this going, are you sure making your bed is going to give me a better day? But this is a US military general that's been there and done it and experienced things that you and I never will. And he's spoken to so many people about this. And every time they go, yeah, you start the day in the right way and it carries on.
But it's almost like you create a scaffolding effect, don't you? So you put the foundations in and then you can build on those foundations, that then you've got the habit of maybe eating a piece of fruit with breakfast. Then you've got the habit of walking that extra stop on where the bus is rather than riding it all the way. So you get into these positive habits that just reinforce the next one and the next one.
So true. And if you're listening to this and you're thinking, yeah, but how do I even begin this? You don't actually have to change anything in your life. You carry on doing exactly the same things that you're always doing. But every time you make a decision, you just ask yourself, do I really need to make this decision or that decision? And if it's that decision that is a bit harder, but it feels like the right one, that's what you should go with. And then the other thing that, do you remember when William said, if you want to change the world, find someone to paddle alongside you? That's the other thing, Damien, picking people that encourage you to do this stuff. Because if you're surrounded by people that are telling you not to make those good choices, it is so hard.
Yeah, definitely. That we need to have people that share some of the same habits. Because we've said this before on the podcast, that naturally we're pack animals as a species. We like being with other people. We're social. So if you can get people that share some of those same habits and intentions and dreams, it can only help you.
So there you go. Make your bed, do the right thing, find people that encourage you to do the right thing. And it's not about big stuff. It's about those little everyday changes that can make a big difference to your life. And a huge thanks again to Rick, not just for coming on the podcast and for sharing the podcast with his patients, but for the hard work that he puts into the NHS, along with everyone else who's been so important to us in the UK and abroad during the pandemic. Damien, thanks ever so much as always, buddy.
No, thanks, Jake. Loved it.
Me too. Big thanks as well to Finn Ryan at Rethink Audio, to the whole high performance team, including Will and Eve and Hannah. And most of all, though, just a huge thanks to you, really, listening to this. Please remember that there is no secret. It is all there for you. Be your own biggest cheerleader. Make world-class basics your calling card, because you deserve it. And we'll see you next time on the High Performance Podcast.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. No matter what you do or what industry you're in, how you communicate is key. Everything you type is equally important to collaboration, and Grammarly can help. Think of it as your AI writing partner, empowering you to communicate effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact in the workplace. 96% of Grammarly users say it helps them craft more impactful writing. And as the gold standard of responsible AI, Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. By understanding your writing in context, Grammarly provides relevant, personalized suggestions. And with tone suggestions, you can navigate even the most difficult work conversations. You can also save time from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds with one click. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.